The standard is a metal sphere. The amount of metal sphere makes is used as the standard. Once again, now, in other words, if the metal sphere is held above the ground at high noon and it casts a shadow on the ground of 1 square meter, that's the projected area. The projected area of a completely conducting metal sphere, if it happened to be 1 square meter, which is a little less than a meter in diameter, would do that. A little bit more than a meter in diameter would do that. Then it is a standard target of one radar square meter, one RCS, radar cross section of a square meter. That, you know, the exact relationship between.
Echo power
where you install the antennas and measure how well the antennas work on the real airplane. They've got one of almost every kind of Air Force airplane and a couple of Navy airplanes up there. So you can measure the echo of your particular aircraft, compare it to a 1 square meter target, reference target, which is this metal sphere. You can also make the standard radar target by making a corner reflector. It's a three surface corner reflector. In other words, if you look at the corner of your room where the two walls come together and it meets the ceiling, that triangular, that those three right angles coming together, you can build a chunk of sheet metal like that, which also has a very well documented amount of echo power. The nice thing about the metal sphere is that no matter what direction you look at it from, north, south, east, west, above, below, and so on, you get the exact same amount of echo. Also, another nice magic thing about the metal sphere is that if you hit it with a radar signal, it reflects that radar signal in all directions isotropically almost. In reality, it gives a slightly stronger signal in the retro direction back to the radar that illuminated it. But in general, in all directions, it gives an echo of almost equal amplitude. The metal sphere does that. In the case of the corner reflector, almost all the power is reflected almost back in the direction where it came from and almost no other direction. So you get, for the size of the object that you put up, you get more echo out of a corner reflector than you do out of the sphere. So you compare your airplane to that standard in order to find out how much echo power it's going to get, give you. Once you know its echo power, once you know the transmitter power, the receiver sensitivity, and the size of the antenna of the radar, you can predict with very good accuracy what range. Now, I have used a ground-based radar that under certain weather conditions in the summertime, I have looked at targets 400 miles away. There are radars that go considerably further than that. Now, did that radar really have a 400-mile range? Yes. For an airplane that's high enough up so that above the Earth's curvature you could see it, you could see that that happened to be an FPS 20 radar that I was using. It worked at the 1296 M band, 1296 megacycles was the frequency of this L band radar that put out, I think it was 10 megawatts of peak envelope power. I think it was something like a 5 or a 10 microsecond long pulse, something like 330 pulses per second. And we had a working model of that in Deer Park at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And we had that was running every day of the year for many years on end. And when I took my break periods, I could go down and look at the radar screen and see what the echoes were like. If the weather conditions were just right, it would paint out the outline of the New Jersey shore.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I got a good day in the summertime when you got the tropospheric conduction radiation, tropospheric propagation conditions going on. I could see the southern tip of New Jersey. I could see Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia. I could see the recognizable shape of the east coast of the United States. You could also every day of the year see the double echo from the World Trade Center, the Empire State Building, and so on. Fun radar to use. So the maximum range you get out of a radar, once you know the size of the antenna, the amount of power out of the transmitter, and the characteristics of the receiver, it is very predictable. Without a doubt, ground-based radars have a bigger antenna, transmit more power. In general, they've got a hell of a lot more range. Airborne radar quite often doesn't need that amount of range, am I? An airborne radar obviously has, in the nose of the airplane, a much smaller antenna. For that reason, it tends to use much higher frequencies. Very few airborne radars today operate below KU band. In other words, very few of them operate lower in frequency than 15 gigahertz. When the dish is small in diameter, you can still get a lot of gain out of it if you go to a small enough wavelength. That's a fancy way of saying high enough frequency. And so, could an airborne radar detect another airplane at 50 miles? Absolutely. And there are various ways you can make the radar very sensitive so it can see a long range. There are various ways you can make a radar measure many of the characteristics of the other airplane. What you'd like to believe is that an ordinary radar can paint a picture of the airplane on the screen. It cannot. You get a dot on the screen which represents the echo from that particular airplane, If the dot is very bright, you know it's a large airplane. If it's dim, you know it's a small airplane. You can also look at other kinds of signature characteristics. The jet engine makes a certain kind of jet engine modulation. The compressor blades make a certain characteristic sound, which can be recognized. And so you quite often can recognize what kind of an airplane you're looking at by the specifics of the echo you get, but it's not a picture. There are various techniques people have worked on over the years where they tried to make a radar give you a real picture of the target, like holography. And this is possible. I mean, can you make an MRI, can you make a radar give you an image that's like an MRI image, you know, magnetic resonance imaging, like an image you get of a biological object in front of that machine? Can you make a radar do that? Not quite. But people are working on techniques to do that. So 50 miles is a reasonable range air-to-air with a good radar. 200 miles, not very likely. Ground-based, easily 200 miles if the target is above the horizon. So this gives you a little bit of a feeling for the word radar. By the way, you can have a lot of fun with your friends, your engineering friends. Like, for instance, by asking the question, what does radar stand for? It's a very simple question. It's like the word Kleenex. We hear the word so often, we know exactly what it means, but what do the original letters stand for? You can have a lot of fun asking your engineering friends that subject, that question. I've done that with a company where every single product for 50 solid years was a radar product. And I asked a whole lot of engineers one day, what does radar stand for? And it was the 15th engineer that I talked to. I was the fifth engineer in the radar department before I got an answer. Part of the reason is it's not a pure acronym. It's a mixture of letters that trace out the words radio, detecting, and ranging. But the RA of radio is the first two letters of it. It's not a pure acronym. And some people in Staten Island, John, know radar so well they can spell it backwards. It gives you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch. The word radar is a very complicated subject. You look at that Skolnick's radar handbook, which is broken down into about 25 chapters, and there are lots of other books with even more elaborate work. There are phased array radars that look at various polarizations and sweeping frequencies. And
repeater, timeout, cancel.
There are radars that on alternate pulses put out different polarization, different amounts of sweeping of the signal during the pulse, that's called chirp, different amounts of digital modulation during the pulse, that's called Barker coding. There are sedan many radars, my goodness. If you tried to list all of the types of radars that exist today, I bet you could easily come up with a list of 40 or 50 different types of radar, depending on frequency polarization, modulation, demodulation, data processing techniques, ranging techniques, tracking techniques, and so on. CW radars are used for guiding missiles from the ground to the air to hit a target, for instance. So there's lots and lots of kinds of radar. So it's not a simple subject. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, great description, Dick. You might want to mention those two books so that Bob can maybe get one of those books and research a little more, because this is a difficult question. And there's, like you said, there is so much to it and so many different types. I think he would better off educating himself that way. So if you could just run those two books again.
Yeah, the two books start off with the Skolnick's Introduction to Radar. Introduction to Radar is the name of his first book. The author's name is Skolnick. And now, how do you spell Skolnick? I'm not absolutely positive. And his main book, the second book, is called The Radar Engineering Handbook? The Radar Handbook? Yeah, Radar Handbook. It's a red book, probably 4 inches thick, normal size. A good technical library will have both of these books, the Introduction to Radar and the Radar Handbook. There's also two or three other books with reference to radar cross-section. I can't think of the name of these two famous books. It'll come to me eventually. But those are very good introductory books. Both of them are broken down. You look at the index or the upfront section. They're broken down into a whole lot of individual chapters discussing the transmitter modulator, the antenna, the feed horn, the receiver, the waveguide techniques for, for instance, one of the kinds of radar is a kind that's called monopulse. In other words, it doesn't have one single horn in front of the parabolic dish. It's got four separate horns. And by the way, you take the signal out of those four horns, put them to a fancy matrix network of waveguide and other products, other components, you end up with a radar that can easily track a target. In other words, if the target moved a little bit in azimuth or elevation, by the way you get the signals that are changing in either amplitude or phase coming out of those four horns at the focal point of that dish, you immediately know exactly which way to run the motors on the dish to move it in azimuth or elevation to track that particular target. And that's a beautiful automated system.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But that just gives you a couple of more little pieces of information about the various kinds of radar. And there are kinds of radars that can have signals that are transmitted with the actual radar pulses, which identify the radar or give other pieces of valuable information to the aircraft that they're talking to, if you know what I mean, or the aircraft that they're tracking. You take, for instance, the FAA radar that's used at airports. Each one of the pulses out of that radar are also turning on a transponder, which is called IFF, Identification Friend or Foe, was the name of that circuitry that was invented by the Brits during World War II. And there was a kind of a transponder on every single commercial airplane these days, which spits back information that lets the radar on the ground know which airplane, what altitude it's at, and so on. And that information gets painted across the screen, but it's being derived by the transponder that's on the airplane that enhances the echo that comes back and gives you additional information, more than just the echo from what they call skin paint. The radar signal that hits the sheet metal of the airplane gives you an echo, and the radar people call that the skin paint. Well, you can have other pieces of electronics on board that see each individual pulse coming out of the ground-based radar and send back a pulse electronically from the aircraft that gives lots of other pieces of information. And that thing is called the transponder, sometimes called the IFF transponder, sometimes called the TACAN transponder. Has a lot of funny names. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RYW, the TechNet.
Boat C is for altitude and aircraft.
KC2WGB. Okay, well, that gives Bob a summer project. 4 inches thick. I'm sure he'll have fun with that. If you're ready, we'll go on to the next one, Dick.
Go right ahead, John, and we better wait for the right amount of time that I didn't do.
All right. Now let's try this one. We've got Joseph in New Jersey. He sent me an image of a Yagi antenna, and it's laying on ground, plan view. We're looking down at the top. It has seven or eight elements. It has three directors, three active elements, and a crazy-looking reflector. It's bent like a trombone, but that doesn't matter. His question is on the active elements. When he looks at it, starting from the first element, the left-hand element, number one, is connected diagonally to the second element on the right, and the first element on the right is connected to the second element on the left, and so on down the boom. What is the reason for that? What are they trying to achieve? And he wants to know, what is the purpose, and how does that work? So that's about it. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
In the early days of Yagis, people made the mistake of putting on, let's say, for instance, a reflector, a driven element, and one or two directors, tune that thing all up right so you get the maximum amount of gain, and then when somebody wanted to make a longer Yagi, they would just simply add more directors out front and leave the current directors in their right positions. And very soon you run out of steam when you do that, somewhere around 8, 9, 10 elements. As you add more elements, you no longer get any increase in performance. That was because of an erroneous understanding of the Yagi process. What you're really doing with those directors is you're making a kind of a magnifying glass, very similar to the thing that you hold in the sun out in front of a piece of newspaper, and you focus the sun onto a small dot, and you burn a hole in the newspaper. That kind of a magnifying glass, the directors are doing that to the radio signal. Your magnifying glass takes the sun, concentrates it to a point, and you burn a hole in a piece of newspaper. The director string also is a kind of an electronic magnifying glass, taking a whole great big chunk of energy out in front and focusing it down to the driven element. However, when you add more and more directors, you have to retune all of the previous directors, their lengths and their positions, so that the whole Don director string is now a magnifying glass with a longer focal length. Once you realize that, then there is no limit to the number of directors you can add. There is a successful antenna design with 102 elements altogether. So it's got, 98 directors plus a reflector and a driven element made by Directive Systems, Gabe Olin, K1WHS. Anyhow, as I said, that's a successful Yagi design that's used at the 3 gigahertz ham band. So because of the early misunderstanding of the Yagi process of retuning, and because people in the beginning just added extra directors, not only did the performance no longer continue to increase, but the antenna became very narrowband. People used to believe that a Yagi has a gain bandwidth product, very similar to an operational amplifier, that if you added more directors and made the Yagi higher in gain, that the bandwidth would go down, the 3 dB bandwidth for 2-to-1 standing wave ratio or whatever. Well, that's not quite true. Once you use some of the modern-day Yagi optimization programs, you suddenly discover that there are ways of tuning a Yagi that gives you quite a bit of bandwidth with almost no sacrifice in the gain. So in the days when they had very narrow-band Yagis, a theory came along that if you use a log periodic antenna as the driven element, let me drop, that those three directors, those three driven elements that you're describing, which have a zigzag piece of metal between the left side and the right side of each half of those dipoles, of the three dipoles that are the driven element, that is a log periodic cell. And I can't think of the name of the guy right now that used to run KLM Electronics. Can't remember his call letters. Guy in California.
Mike Stoll.
That's the one, Mike Stoll. What's Mike Stoll's call letters, Barry?
I don't remember.
You remembered more than I did. And you and I come from the same era. So this man named Mike Stoll, he used to run KLM Electronics in the mid-70s in California. K6MYC, is that it possibly, Barry?
Yeah, you have me running back in the kitchen. Yes, that is the correct call.
So Mike Stoll, K6MYC, came up with this brilliant sounding idea of using a log periodic cell, as he called it, as the driven element assembly. So three or four elements on the KLM Yagis, there's a number of these KLM Yagis still running around the planet, which have these log periodic cells. And the belief was that the log periodic antenna is, by definition, quite broadband, and it has directivity. It aims the signal in one direction. So good common sense would lead you to believe that if the driven element was a log periodic substructure inside of your rest of your Yagi structure, you would get higher gain and more bandwidth. Good sounding theory. The 16-element KLM Yagi, which, if that theory would work, that antenna would probably be 15 or 20 megacycles wide. The 16-element KLM Yagi is 2 megacycles wide, not 20 megacycles wide. So, for a bunch of reasons, the theory didn't work out the way it was supposed to, for a whole bunch of reasons. And so the log periodic cell experiment, by way of computer modeling programs, people rapidly discovered that it doesn't buy you anything in bandwidth, doesn't buy you anything in gain, and it buys you a lot of vulnerability. Let me drop. All of those crisscross pieces of metal have a bunch of aluminum to aluminum contacts held together with a screw out in the weather, and aluminum oxide is building up, and they eventually break contact. So you take a KLM 16 element, or is it a 24 element? I think it's 16 element, the KLM log periodic Yagi. If it's been out in the weather for more than a year or two, You go down that string with your ohm meter, and you'll find out that through those crisscross pieces of metal of the log periodic driven element assembly, you'll find that some of those dipoles are no longer making ohmic contact according to your ohm meter because aluminum oxide built up. So it's a very vulnerable antenna that degrades in time. You could shine it up and make very good contact today with steel wool or a Scotch-Brite, and you could make it work as well as it did on the day it was designed. It's a medium-good antenna, not a highly competitive antenna in the antenna game competitions. That was one of the disappointments that was discovered real fast. So you now know it's got normal directors, it's got this log periodic driven element assembly, and various versions of it have either a single reflector or a trigonal reflector system. There's a whole series of Yagis made by the Cushcraft Company where the reflector is not just one single reflector, but it's a reflector mounted on the boom and another reflector mounted above the boom and another one below the boom at that same location. It's called the trigonal reflector system. And in theory, it was supposed to give a better front-to-back ratio and higher gain. Well, in reality, Mr. Cushman told the antenna designer at the time, gee, I've seen a picture of this thing with a trigonal reflector. It looks kind of sexy. I want our product to have that. So he told the man who was doing the design at the time, add these extra directors. Even if it doesn't change the performance, it'll help the sales. So various people have built that or have modified the Cushcraft Yagi and discovered that the trigon
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Various people did a number of antenna range experiments or computer modeling and discovered that the trigonal reflector system doesn't buy you any front-to-back ratio improvement or any gain improvement. It was used on a number of military antennas on Yagi-like radar systems. It was done for a different purpose. I won't go into that right now, but it didn't drastically improve the front-to-back ratio or the gain. So I'm pretty sure what you're looking at is a KLM brand Yagi. It was roughly 1975 vintage, and there's quite a few of them still running around the world today, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Here's DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, DPZ. Hal?
That same theory is used on the TV aerials, for it's broadbanding TV aerials. This is my only comment, K6DPZ.
Yeah, Doug recognized with those extra trigonal reflectors, the reflector that's above and below the boom, tuning them to a different length than the one that's on the boom can give you extra bandwidth. That's pretty sure what some of the television aerials are using, and that's what I think Hal is bringing to our attention. Doug, I wonder if you've had some experience with trigonal reflector systems. WA2SAY, K2RIW.
Thank WA2SAY and back to the net. I'm going to back up just a little bit. I went to the internet and I put in Skolnick, an introduction to radar systems, and it turns out you can get a freebie for it. You can download the thing for nothing. Put in Skolnick, S-K-O-L-N-I-K, introduction to radar systems, and find an outfit called We Got Media, and you can download the whole book, Skolnick, Introduction to Radar Systems, 3rd edition, IE, I don't know what that is, in PDF format, and you can download the whole thing. And I got a great big monster URL, but you'll have to look it up. There's no sense reading this thing, it's 3 lines long. So I figured I would let you know. WA2SAY, back to net.
Hey, Doug, that's very good information. So Skolnick, S-K-O-L-N-I-K, and that's the author's name, Mr. Skolnick, has a very good book called Introduction to Radar. And according to Doug, if you Google the word combination Skolnick or Introduction to Radar, you will eventually find a site that says We Got Media. It's part of the addressing of the website, but the site itself has got a very long name. But by Googling it, if I understand correctly, I'm going to pass it back to Doug in a minute for a repeat. I believe he found it by either Googling Skolnick Introduction to Radar or by Googling the word We Got Media. But anyhow, of the couple of books, good technical books that you can download free of charge, apparently that book, if you bought it these days, the Skolnick Radar Handbook, I am guessing is around $150. The Introduction to Radar, I am guessing is in the $50 category. That's a guess on my part as to what you might, particularly if you buy it brand new, if you're willing to get it used, I know you can get them cheaper. But it looks like the price is right, that if you're willing to download all of those pages. Now, for me, I'd rather have the real book on the shelf with the real binding as opposed to a whole bunch of pages that I print out myself and try to staple together. But depending on your economic resources, you might be very happy with the pages all stapled together because the price is right. So, was I slightly right in the way I guessed as to how you found that website, Doug? WA2SAY, K2RAW on TechNet. I wait for all four beeps.
K6DPZ, another comment.
Doug first, and then we'll pick up Hal after that. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, I only got one beep, but I guess you can hear me. Okay, I googled for Skolnick, and the correct name of the book is Introduction to Radar Systems. Introduction to Radar Systems. And you google for that, and you'll get a bunch of answers. One of them is from a company or a website called We Got Media. And when you sign up, you will get a page that says you need to sign up to download Skolnick Introduction to Radar Systems 3EIE McGraw 1981 PDF. And I wouldn't print this whole thing out. It must be like 300 or 400 pages or something like that. But I would download it, and which I am going to do, of course. And just look at the index and look up what you want to do, and you know, and just go to those pages in the PDF. I did the same thing with a great big radio handbook, and it really is handy. I didn't have the book, but I did have the CD, so I copied it. In this case, you have to make your own CD. WA2SAY, back to net.
Very good information, Doug. Okay, so Introduction to Radar Systems, and yes, it's a McGraw-Hill book, very famous book. So now you know those two really good books. Radar Handbook by Skolnick, same name, Skolnick, and Introduction to Radar Systems. There's another very good book. Unfortunately, it's a little bit expensive. It's a large format, very well illustrated book by the Hughes Aircraft Company. I think they did that around 1980 or so. And Hughes Aircraft was making airborne radars at the time, and this was a book intended for internal consumption only. And for the first 10 or 15 or 20 years of its existence, that book wasn't allowed out of the company. You can now buy it. And it's called Airborne Radar by Hughes. I can't think of the author's name, but somebody will eventually come up with that one. The Hughes book is a larger format, probably 3 inches thick, extremely well illustrated. And of the 50 kinds of radar, I'll bet you 40 of them are in that Hughes book with beautiful explanations as to how it works, with very nice visualizations, computer-generated graphics in Technicolor, if you know what I mean. Very well done. Let's see what Hal's got to add to all this. K6, Delta Papa Zulu, K2RAW in the TechNet.
RAW in TechNet, K6DPC. I just wanted to say, if you go up on the Government Printing Office site, you can find some very good books dealing with radar. And they're not very expensive. You just have to scroll down, see what their listings are, and get it through a Government Printing Office. And it's proportionally for what you get, the knowledge, and for what you pay, it's a pittance. Go ahead, Doug. K2RIW, K6DPZ.
Very fine, Hal. Thank you for that information. The first 40 years, let me think now, 35 years, I worked for one particular company for 35 years, straight out of school, out of college. That was Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and essentially every single product they built was radar-oriented. So, in the five different departments that I worked for over those 35 years, I saw an awful lot of radar. Rotary joints and antennas and feed horns and transmitters and receivers and modulators and demodulators and receiver techniques and pulse compression techniques and whatever. UBM amazed how much there is involved with radar. You could almost say that of all the wireless communication systems that are in use today, that includes your cell phone and all your WAN, LAN, and whatever, an awful lot of the techniques were really developed in the process of engineering good radar systems, both ground-based, sea-based, and air-based radar systems. So a lot of very fancy engineering development took place on the subject of radar originally and then got reapplied in other places. So learning radar, if you want to know wireless electronics, learning radar is a very good thing to study from my point of view. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RYW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, learned something myself tonight. That description of the live periodic insert is very interesting. I did not know that was the reason that was done. But, okay, so Joe's got his answer. One more if you got time.
Yes, I think we should. And after that, I'm going to take a quick listen to see if Paul is available, WS2N, because he did say he had a space report. But give us our third question for the night. Over to you, John.
Okay. We've got a ham here who's confused because he heard two conversations when we were discussing microwave, and he was, let me see now, the easiest way I can put this in boxed waveguide. He heard you say that the radiation travels down, slamming from side to side in the waveguide, and very little is striking the top. It tends to follow the side to side. Is that a correct assumption?
From the words that I use, you could easily get that impression, John. If you could stop time, look at the wave as it's going down a piece of waveguide and study it a millimeter at a time, you would find out that the wave itself acts as if it was in completely free space. In other words, it really has a planar wave front, and the E and the H, in other words, the magnetic field at right angles to the electrostatic field, the electric field, 90 degrees apart. It really looks like it's a free space wave, with one exception. Good common sense would lead you to believe that the wave is going to go straight down the middle of the waveguide, just like your eyesight does. Your eyesight goes down the middle of the guide because your eyesight is a wavelength of 540 nanometers. In other words, the wavelength of your eyesight is an extremely small wavelength. Therefore, it has complete freedom to go down the center of the guide. If you could take the frequency of your eyesight and slowly lower it to lower and lower frequencies or to greater and greater wavelengths, eventually your eyesight would no longer go straight down the guide. It would be a little bit more like a kaleidoscope. It would have to bounce off the walls is the only way the signal can get down there. So if you took a piece of rectangular waveguide and took the broad wall and laid it flat on the table, now the dominant mode by which the wave can go down that guide has the E field up and down, vertical, perpendicular to the page, to the table, and the H field is horizontal, the magnetic field is horizontal, and the wave is going down the guide by bouncing from the left and right hand narrow vertical walls. And it's not one simple bounce. It's bouncing like a pair of scissors.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Like a pair of scissors. In other words, if I take a pair of scissors and open them up so that the jaws of the scissors are opened at, let me pick a number, a 35-degree angle, and now I make believe that each blade of the scissors represents the bore site of one of the radio waves going down that waveguide. So at each particular position, there's a wave slanted to the right at roughly a 30-degree angle. There's a second wave slanted to the left at a 30-degree angle at that particular position in the waveguide. And then those waves progress forward at those particular angles, bounce off the vertical walls, and then meet at the center again at this 30-degree angle, and then repeat the process over and over again. The horizontal walls on top and bottom are definitely required. Is the wave bouncing off of those? No. In the dominant mode, called the TE-10 mode, TE-10 mode, all of the bounce is off of the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall. You go a little bit. You go about 80% higher in frequency than the main center frequency that that waveguide was designed for. Now, for the first time, you have the ability to send a wave down the guide in the other mode, not TE-10, but TE-01. Where now you can bounce it vertically up and down off of the upper horizontal wall and the lower horizontal wall. It takes a higher frequency, a shorter wavelength, before Mother Nature will let you do that. Choose a high enough frequency, you can send the wave down the waveguide in a number of different modes, as they're called. Really, it means the way it's bouncing. There's a number of different ways you can bounce. And there are different kinds of bounces for round waveguide and rectangular waveguide. But one of the subjects I heard discussed this week on the TechNet is somebody asked, what's the highest possible frequency that you can do radio? And there is no limit. The word microwave. The word microwave back in 1930 used to mean higher than 100 megacycles. Let me drop. Nowadays, most people believe microwave means higher than 1,000 or higher than 3,000, depending on which book you read. Each frequency region has a letter designation. The VHF region goes from 30 to 300. The UHF region goes from 300 to 3,000 megacycles. S-band goes from roughly 2 to 4. C-band goes roughly 4 to 8. X-band roughly 8 to 12. There's letter and various letter combinations for each frequency region. Millimeter wave really means waves that are, well, let me backtrack a little bit. If I go above 10 gigahertz, 10 gigahertz handband is called the 3 centimeter band. The wavelength there is roughly 1 inch, 3 centimeters. The SHF band goes from roughly, I think it's 1 gigs, no, 30 gigs is the high end, 3 gigs to 30 gigs. Is a particular band which is larger than millimeter wave. The wavelength there is the centimeter band, I would call it. So you rate the wavelength in centimeters when you're between 3,000 and 30,000 megacycles. 3,000 and 30,000 megacycles. Nowadays they call it gigahertz, you know what I mean. 3 to 30 gigahertz is the centimeter band. The wavelength goes below a centimeter when you're above 30 gigahertz. So the 30 gigahertz to 300 gigahertz is called the millimeter band. So now you rate it in millimeters. Exactly 30 gigahertz is 10 millimeters, or 1 centimeter. Above 300 gigahertz is the sub-millimeter band. Above 1,000 gigahertz, they call it the terahertz region. So you no longer rate it in gigahertz, you rate it in terahertz. You can buy laboratory equipment, you can buy off the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
From the Militech company in the Boston area, you can buy terahertz chunks of electronics. Electronics that are designed, feed horns, waveguides, mixers and whatever, that operate up to numbers like 3 terahertz, which is 3,000 gigahertz. What's the highest frequency? And by the way, when you go above the terahertz band, you're starting to get into what's called far infrared, then near infrared, and then optical, and then ultraviolet, and so on. The spectrum is absolutely continuous. Where does radio end and light wave begin, or infrared begin? It's a matter of what equipment you're using and what definition you want to use. The spectrum is absolutely continuous. So you can start off at 10 hertz and go all the way up to at least 10 terahertz, and you could, if you want to, either call the 10 terahertz, you could call it the sub-millimeter wave, you could call it the terahertz region, or you could call it the far infrared. And if your eyes operated, let me think now. The next question people ask is, if I go high enough in frequency where it's at far infrared and I use the right kind of a camera, can I measure the signal coming off the antenna with optical techniques? Could I take a picture of the signal coming off the antenna because it really is a far infrared wave? Believe it or not, the answer is yes. So Is there a difference between light wave and radio wave? No. It's the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. It's just a matter of what frequency you're using, or what wavelength you call it, and what instrumentation you're using to send it out, or to receive it, or to measure it. There is no real sharp line of demarcation where radio ends and light begins. They really are the exact same spectrum. So there are a number of... Among Tom Williams, WA1MBA's microwave group, his microwave reflector, that listserv, among those 400 people, some of those people will end each one of their emails saying that no frequency is high enough. These guys have discovered that as you go to higher and higher frequencies, which ham radio has done over and over again, starting in the 20s when we discovered that the high frequency bands and the ultra high frequency bands, which used to be considered useless, are now very valuable, you discover that no matter what frequency you're on, you go to the next higher frequency, when you develop the right kind of equipment that properly uses that frequency, you get significant benefit out of it. There is no end. So therefore, these guys who are very progressive and say no frequency is high enough, they're really saying something, in my opinion, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW of the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, yeah, agree 100%. I was involved in that conversation. And it was a question of what frequencies, what are the highest frequencies they're working with right now? I know people who are actively in 41 gigahertz, and I've heard of it going up as high as 250 gig. I don't know anybody that's running up in that category, but you're right. If you get that oscillator to swing, there's no limit. The question on this waveguide was, the gentleman is confused because he heard the conversation about the square waveguide, or rectangular waveguide, and he also heard a conversation we had about you using the 3/4-inch pipe for a waveguide. And that's where he got confused. How does it propagate down a round waveguide? So you already touched on the fact that there's, you know, round waveguide, box waveguide, but he is confused at how you could send the 10 gigahertz going side to side and up and down when it's a round object. So that's the basis of his confusion.
Yeah, when it comes to really progressive high-frequency ham radio operators, remember the name Brian Justin, Whiskey Alpha 1 Zebra Mike Sierra, WA1ZMS. Brian Justin holds the U.S. distance record on the 241 gigahertz ham band. He holds the U.S. distance record. He has already experimented on something like 350 and 450 gigahertz. With homebrew equipment. So there are guys that are higher and higher in frequency. Without a doubt, the guys who are on 10 gigahertz handband, and I'm one of them, the lowest loss waveguide you can use that anybody has ever invented happens to be identical to the stuff you can get at a Home Depot. It's called 3/4-inch round water pipe. 3/4-inch round water pipe has just the right inside diameter to do a beautiful job of sending a 10 gigahertz ham radio signal down that guide as if it was waveguide. It is waveguide. It has lower loss than rectangular guide. The signal is bouncing back and forth from the so-called vertical wall. That takes an explanation. When you and I look at the lawn in your backyard, you see grass. In some places you might see a little bit of dirt. But you see the individual leaves of grass, you see details, because your eyes are using an extremely small wavelength, 550 nanometers, very, very small wavelength. Therefore, it has high resolution capability. If your eyes operated at the 20-meter handband, where the wavelength is 20 meters, 60 feet long, instead of an extremely small fraction of an inch, which is your optical wavelength, if you're using a wavelength that's 60 feet long, and you look at that backyard, that grass, the dirt, the slight undulations of the dirt, because the dirt ends in one place and your flower bed begins and whatever, to your 20-meter eyes, that would look like a nearly perfect, smooth mirror. Because the undulations of your dirt, you're talking about undulations here of maybe your lawn has got peaks and valleys that go up and down by 6 inches, half a foot. Well, half a foot of peak to valley of undulations of your lawn is 1/120th of a wavelength on the 20-meter hemband. You can see how a 20-meter wavelength would not see those details. It would all get washed out. It would look like a perfect mirror. Let me drop. Okay. The wavelength at 10 gigahertz hemband is roughly 1 inch. Your water pipe is 3/4 inch in diameter. That wave going down the water pipe doesn't know it is round. It bounces off those so-called vertical walls of the round waveguide as if it was completely flat. It cannot see those details. Your first question is going to be, isn't the signal that's bouncing off the round pipe left and right, the part that's bouncing at the 1 o'clock position versus the 3 o'clock position, isn't the 1 o'clock position, because it doesn't have as much distance left and right from the center, isn't that signal going to be a little bit earlier in phase compared to the bounce at 3 o'clock? Good common sense on one single bounce says yes, that will take place. But because the waveguide is so small in wavelengths, because your wavelength is so big, Mother Nature, after that bounce, takes that uneven signal that we've just described, reassembles it, puts it all back together. I know that part is not easy to accept. You'll have to take my word for it. But that wave cannot see those details. It thinks it's in a square pipe. It behaves almost identically as if it was a rectangular pipe, even though it's a round piece of guide. But in the process, the way the currents form on those walls, let me drop. The way a vertically polarized wave, which bounces from left to right across that round piece of pipe, because of where the currents form, because it doesn't have the sharp corners, there's a whole bunch of fine details involved. When you study what really happens, the round piece of pipe has probably 20% less loss per foot compared to mil-spec, silver-plated, dry nitrogen-filled WR90 rectangular waveguide. WR stands for waveguide rectangular. 90 means it's 9/10 of an inch horizontal width. That's the standard guide used for rectangular waveguide for the 10 gigahertz, for 8 to 12 gigahertz region. So rectangular waveguide, beautiful looking stuff, has higher loss than the stuff you can buy out of Home Depot. Of course that sounds crazy. You're about to ask, why doesn't everybody use round pipe? And there's a couple of very good reasons. If the round pipe was absolutely round, had no runout of any kind, then when you send the signal at the bottom of the tower up that guide with horizontal polarization, it would arrive at the top of the guide with horizontal polarization. If there is the slightest bit of runout, if you take your round piece of pipe in Home Depot, as I've done, and you walk up to it with a pair of calipers, and you rotate the pipe in the calipers to find out if it has runout, and you find out that one piece of pipe out of three has no measurable amount of runout, but the other two have a slightly measurable amount of runout. You choose the ones with the runout, and you push them together with the couplings, and you make round rectangular, round water pipe waveguide out of it. It is very easy to launch the signal horizontal, polarized at the bottom of the tower, and it arrives vertically polarized at the top of the tower. Because of the runout, the signal polarization will twist in round pipe. That's its major disadvantage. Its second disadvantage is that the lowest frequency and the highest frequency, where it gives you a clearly defined single mode of propagation, round waveguide is very narrowband compared to rectangular. So for a bunch of reasons, rectangular is very popular because the polarization is absolutely locked in. You know exactly what polarization is going to have, whether you've got 1 foot or 1 mile of the stuff. By the way, don't use a mile of it. That's another whole subject. And second of all, it has a much broader bandwidth. When rectangular WR90 waveguide is rated to be used from 0.8, from 8 gigahertz to 12 gigahertz inclusive, and there's a bunch of guard band around that. You could stretch that quite a bit further. You could probably use it all the way down to 6 gigahertz and all the way up to 15 gigahertz, and it would work very, very well. But it has very clearly defined performance from 8 to 12, whereas the round water pipe, I don't know if you would want to go much below 10 or much above 11 or 11 and a half. It's much more narrow band in its clearly defined characteristics. You pays your money, you takes your choice. But round water pipe reflects the signal the exact
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Round water pipe reflects the signal the exact same way, even though good, clear common sense of your eye looking down that pipe saying, how in the world can it get a nice, clear bounce off that little rounded wall? It does.
Can you approach that pipe with a circular?
Absolutely. If you want to send a circular polarized wave, as many people have done, down a round piece of pipe, it'll support circular signal beautifully. And now by using circular, and Barry's got a damn good idea, by using circular polarization in his round pipe, he doesn't care if the pipe has run out. If the pipe had a whole lot of run out, what would happen is that he sends a beautiful circular polarized wave at the bottom. The circular polarized wave would arrive at the top of the tower, and it would have a little bit of axial ratio to it. In other words, pure circular polarization, as you take a linear sensing antenna and you rotate it 360 degrees, you'll see equal amplitude when you're looking at a circular polarized signal. If the signal has a little bit of axial ratio, maybe when your horizontally polarized sensing antenna is at the 3 o'clock position, you'll see a little bit more signal than at the 12 o'clock position. That's called axial ratio, and or it's also called ellipticity of the polarization. You'll end up with a little bit of ellipticity. And Barry is smart enough to put a couple of tuning screws in the side of that round pipe to even make that disappear. So, are you planning on making circular polarization of a 10 gigahertz signal and a round piece of Home Depot copper pipe, Barry? N2 Moondance, K2RIW TechNet. Damn good idea.
That's exactly what I'm planning on doing. And how much loss could I expect in that copper pipe, say 10 feet, 100 feet? What would be the expected loss?
Brand new rectangular guide, silver plated, dry nitrogen filled, brand new out of the box, so to speak, has approximately 4.5 dB per 100 feet at 10 gigahertz, rectangular guide. Round guide is a little bit lower than that. I'm going to make a guess it's 4.0. It's around 4.0 dB per 100 feet. So if you're going to run 100 or 200 feet of it, and you're willing to tolerate that amount of insertion loss, that stuff is good. Waveguide is a beautiful substance for transmitting the signal with a lot lower loss than coax at that frequency, and it's extremely well shielded. The signal inside of a well-assembled piece of waveguide is very well isolated from anything going on the outside. So it's extremely well shielded and very clearly defined, if you know what I mean. But it does have loss. And there's no way of making the loss go to zero without making it superconducting, cryogenic cooling. As crazy as that sounds, Bell Labs has done that. They did cryogenically cool a piece of waveguide that was on the feed horn assembly of the Echo experiment way back in the late 1960s, right around the same time that Penzias and Wilson were using their hug horn and measuring the residual of the Big Bang, and they got their Nobel Award for doing that, Nobel Prize. So, waveguide is great stuff. Don't use a lot of it. Let me drop. If you must transmit a signal more than, let me pick a number, 200 feet or so, which means with a rectangular guide, you're going to get 9 dB of loss per 200 feet at 10 gigs. And as you go up in frequency, where you use smaller guides, the loss increases. So, if you've got to go to more than 100 or 200 feet of distance that you want to convey your signal with low loss, although waveguide looks like the most attractive way compared to coax or compared to strip line or compared to triplate strip line and so on, there is a better technique. It's called beam waveguide. You literally have a parabolic dish at the bottom of the tower aimed at a parabolic dish at the top of the tower, and you send the signal from one antenna to the other antenna. In that case, 100 feet of tower with beam waveguide, you could make the insertion loss probably under 1 dB, maybe even half a dB, whereas the waveguide would be 4.5 dB per 100 feet. But you wouldn't have complete shielding. But there's ways of getting around all that. But that gives you some ideas, doesn't it, Barry? Now you know why a fly swatter or periscope antenna system is so popular. It really is using beam waveguide. There's a parabolic dish at the bottom of the tower, aimed straight up in the air.